So as Mike mentioned, I'm from San Francisco, which is a little bit like living in the three-ring circus. Particularly now it's an election year and we have mayoral election coming up. And of course, when people come to visit us, the comment we always make is, well, you're not in Kansas anymore. So everybody's been saying to us, well, you're not in California anymore, Lou. And Mike and I were talking earlier about the Home on the Range, which is actually a favorite song of mine. I'm a guitarist and I play around campfires and stuff. But the versions I know are slightly different. Where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word. What the hell can an antelope say? And then, of course, the other comment that I made to Mike was, you show me a home with a buffalo roam and I'll show you one heck of a messy living room. So, I don't normally open with jokes. That wasn't really a joke. That was really a comment. We're here today to talk about leadership. So let me get the show on the road here. It's morning in your city. It's a nice, quiet morning. Your city is about 250,000 inhabitants, and life is really good. The birds are singing, the sun is shining. It's a beautiful day. Most people are religious observances because you're a very religious town. You're the center of government for your state. So that brings you a lot of political clout. You have a busy port that brings in an astronomical amount of money and funding, and the quality of life in your jurisdiction is really very, very good. So on the whole, you're considered a leadership role for your state. You're considered a font of knowledge and sophistication. You're a pretty important city. Without warning, you get three sharp jolts and a major earthquake hits. Later on, you'll find out that it's about 8.6 on the Richter scale, which is a really, really big earthquake. And of course, as you would expect, buildings collapse all over town. Thousands are trapped in the rubble. Thousands are killed outright. The earthquake starts a fire. Actually, it starts multiple fires. It also, by the way, breaks open your prisons. It also breaks open your mental institutions, so you've got all sorts of different things going on. But the fires begin to come together. And they get bigger, and they get bigger, and they create a firestorm that threatens to destroy your entire city. Most people, to get away from the fires, decide that the safest place is the waterfront. So they run down to the port, and they look to escape by water. 20 minutes after the earthquake, three large tsunami waves as high as 40 feet hit, killing again thousands of people along the waterfront, flooding what's going on around the waterfront area. Within a matter of minutes, your city, which has been the jewel of your country, has been reduced to rubble. Buildings are destroyed. Damage is pretty close to about half your gross domestic product. 30 to 40,000 of your 250,000 people lie dead. And the fires that are destroying what is left after the tsunami are going to burn for 6 days. And your head of government turns to you and says, "What are we going to do?" Think about that for a minute. You've got this level of devastation, and they're looking at you and saying, "What are you going to do?" I'd like to say that this was a hypothetical scenario that I made it up and I tried to come up with the worst case, but this is an actual event. The pictures that I've used are modern pictures, but this event actually occurred in 1755 in the city of Lisbon. The official that was commenting, asking what should be done, was in fact the King of Portugal. And the man he turned to is a man named Carvalho, who was later known in history as the Marquis of Pombal. Pombal was supposed to have remarked, "Bury the dead, feed the living." Now, one of the things that's interesting of the Marquis of Pombal is that he's ahead of his time. He goes out and he looks at the problem and he starts thinking about what needs to be done and he takes first things first. He deals, of course, with the fact that there are thousands of dead, that there's fires going on, that people need to be fed. But ultimately, he looks ahead, and he understands a couple of things that are going on. For the next 15 years, he's going to drive the reconstruction of the city of Lisbon. He's going to make it the jewel of Europe. He's going to rebuild things better than they were before. He's going to widen the avenues. He's going to raise the level of the houses. He's going to create the science of seismology. He actually goes out and studies what happens in the earthquake, what damage occurs, and how people end up how people survived. And he uses that in reconstruction. Pombal succeeds for three reasons. First, of course, is that he has the support of his political leadership. The king trusts him. The king makes him prime minister and gives him full authority to do what he needs to do. The second thing that gets him ahead is that he is smart enough to recruit the best possible people he can for his team, and he listens to their advice before making decisions. Now, this isn't a man that is a hands-off kind of guy. When he's reconstructing Portugal, or Lisbon, he actually gets down to naming the individual streets. Talk about a little bit hands-on. But he's smart enough to know that he is not an architect, so he relies on his chief architect to tell him things he should do. He has plans put in place. He listens to the people that know what they're talking about. The third thing he has that I think is probably most important is he has a vision. And this is really what I think the crux of leadership is and what we'll talk about a little bit today, is Pombal understands that his problem is not just to put out fires and to feed people that are hungry. He understands the implications of the destruction of the city of Lisbon. He understands that if he takes the option of moving the capital, or if he chooses not to reconstruct the capital, it could well lead to the fall of the monarchy, and the whole power structure would change. Lisbon at this time occupies a central position in politics in Europe because of the money that flows through it. It has the gold trade, the slave trade, so they have a lot of influence on the rest of Europe. That's at risk because the capital has been destroyed. So he needs to understand what needs to be done to bring things back online as quickly as possible. And to that end, everything that he does from the very beginning works towards that vision. So the question becomes, so that's great, he was the prime minister, he's got a lot of power, what difference can I make? History is replete with a lot of examples in any arena of people that have made a difference because they stepped forward at the time of crisis. And so we're going to talk about that today. You don't have to be a Marquis of Pombal. You really don't. Because most of the people that show leadership in crisis are unsung heroes, people that we never hear of. The ones that we hear are the ones that rise above the crowd, that get noticed. But the simple fact is there are many, many, many heroes, as you all know in your day-to-day work, who step forward in crisis, show leadership, and get people back on the right track. The Athenian general Chabrias was supposed to remark that an army of sheep led by a lion is more to be feared than an army of lions led by sheep. So the point that I would like you to take away is you don't have to be a heroic individual. But you can make a difference as a leader in crisis. And we're going to talk about some of the things that people can do to do things better in crisis, some of the things that they can put in place. Because one of the things that I think is a fallacy is we assume that leaders are born. Now, there certainly are people that, and we've all met them in life, that are really outstanding, that yes, they seem like they were from the cradle, they were destined to be leaders. That's not the case for most people. Most people, leadership is in fact something that we can learn. There are techniques that we can teach. And unfortunately, as emerging managers, one of the things that we don't teach is leadership. We are very good at preparing programs. We're very good at preparing organizations. We're very good at building teams and preparing teams. But we really don't prepare ourselves to lead in crisis. So let's talk about this a little bit and see, first of all, how things will react, how we will react in crisis. I think before we can talk about some of the other things that are out there and how we should act in crisis, it's important that we understand what goes on internally in ourselves during the time of crisis. In her book, The Unexpected, which is a book that I actually recommend, Amanda Ripley identifies three phases that are present in any crisis. The first is the phase of denial. And this, any of you that have been in crisis, and gee, I don't think there are too many of you that have been in crisis here, right? Right. Any of us that have been in crisis know that our first reaction is astonishment. If you've ever been in a car accident, if you've ever been injured, if you've ever been in a major crisis, you know that your first reaction is to not believe it. You are astonished. I was in the military once and actually was unfortunate enough to have a Jeep roll over me. I wasn't injured at all. But the last thought that was going through my mind as this Jeep was rolling over and I really thought I was being killed was, I can't believe this is happening. When I suddenly realized I wasn't going to die, my next thought was, Captain Rolfe is going to kill me. I just crashed his Jeep. So many things happen during your mind. So denial is a natural human reaction. This is something that happens to us by a matter of course. And there are all sorts of psychological reasons why we go into denial. But suffice it to say that our tendency initially is to freeze when confronted with a crisis. Thank you. The next phase is deliberation. And by deliberation, I'm not talking about necessarily a rational approach to sitting down, gathering information, analyzing the situation, and thinking about problems. What we're really talking about here is something called milling, what Dr. Dennis Miletti refers to as milling. And milling means we're seeking corroboration. First we denied that anything was going on, then we're thinking, well, maybe something did happen, and now we start to try and figure out what that's all about. And that's where you start hearing questions like, did you feel that? Did you hear that? Did you smell that? We're looking to our colleagues, to our friends, to the people around us, and we're saying, you know, did this really happen? You know, is this for real? And then we try to figure out what is going on with this particular crisis and determine, what's this really mean to me? Because ultimately, by the way, when we're sending out messages to the public, you can tell them all you want about the particular disaster, but what they really want to hear from you is, what does this mean to me? If you think back to September 11th and some of the messages that were coming out of Washington, they didn't meet that criteria. What we were telling people, it's the end of the world as we know it, terrorists are coming to get you. And the next question, of course, logically, that they wouldn't answer is, so what does that mean to me? What's my risk? What do you need me to do? So it becomes very personal. So that phase of deliberation is a very important part of moving us from that stage of denial into the final phase, which is actually making a decision to act. Now, the problem in crisis is a lot of people never get to that decision point. And that's, I think, one of the important things about being a leader, is at a certain point, you have to act. You have to make a decision. You have to go one way or the other. And that's not easy to do, because you won't have the information you need. You'll be scared. You'll be wondering if you're stepping outside your authority. But somebody has to take responsibility, and at a certain point, you have to act. So let me go into this a little bit further and talk about coping mechanisms. A couple of researchers, Janice and Mann, in 1977, way back in 1977, who came up with something called the conflict theory model. And what this talks about are coping mechanisms for how we deal with crisis. And I think it's worth looking at as emergency managers, because it really talks, it was written specifically, by the way, based on a study of emergency warnings and emergency notifications and how people react to them. So I think it's really an interesting model for us to look at as emergency managers. The first thing that happens when a crisis occurs is we ask a basic question. And the basic question is just what we just talked about. What's this mean to me? If we find that this particular, the first stage, that there's no risk to continuing doing what we're doing, we'll continue to do it. Unconflicted inertia. We just keep doing what we've been doing. If we don't get further information that tells us that this is in fact an actual crisis, our tendency is to continue to keep doing what we've been doing. So again, that denial phase coming in. If in fact we look at this and we understand that, yeah, there is something else going on, and if I continue to do what I'm doing, it's going to cause me more trouble and actually doing something, the next question we ask is, well, of the things that I have to do, is there a risk involved in me doing one of these actions? So the first question, of course, is there a risk if I don't do anything? But the second part is, are there risks if I do, in fact, do something? It's a bit of a subtle distinction. But what we're really looking at, are there different ways of attacking this thing, and is there one that is really easy and really expedient? Let me give you a couple of examples. In the first phase, when we talk about people and unconflicted inertia, we talk about, for example, the many times that we've given warnings about tornadoes, about floods, about fires, and people don't seem to react to them. They see no immediacy. It's easier for them to make the decision to stay in place. When we move into the next phase where, yes, there are in fact some options that we have to look at, and it's more risky to not do something, then we start looking at options. And this is where we get into the area of, should we or should we not evacuate? And a lot of times we choose not to evacuate because it is easier to select something that is expedient rather than to make the hard decision, because we don't like the decisions that we have to be able to make. In other words, the alternatives are sort of unpalatable to us. But in fact, if there is a risk, the next phase that we move into, the next question we ask is, are there better alternatives than the ones I'm looking at here? And this really gets into the realm of hope. If in fact I can hope to come up with a different solution, then I'm inclined to seek more information. If I find that no, there are really no good solutions to this, I have a tendency to go into this sort of inertial phase, this phase of just spinning my wheels. And this is where people start to shut down and stop looking at information. In other words, they reflect the problem in terms that they're expecting to see rather than basing it on the information they're actually getting. So again, if you look at the distinctions, the first phase is, the first coping mechanism is, I'm not going to do anything because there's no risk in not doing that. The second phase is, I've got a bunch of risky alternatives, so I'll pick the easiest one. And the third phase is, yeah, I've got a whole bunch of alternatives, none of them are particularly good, but I do have the option of getting some other alternatives if I gather more information. The next one is a question of time. If, in fact, we have time to make decisions, we're in pretty good shape, but a lot of times we don't have that time, and we get into something called hypervigilance. Hypervigilance is a state that, in its worst case, devolves into panic. But this is the area where our stress goes through the roof, we start making bad decisions, we start looking at information differently, we stop gathering information. And finally, if we do have the time, then we go into the state of vigilance. Now, one of the things that's happening along this line is at each of these levels, our stress is going up. And those of you who are familiar with Art Botterill's laws of emergency management, the first law of emergency management is stress makes you stupid. Now, stress is not always a bad thing, and when we get into the vigilance state, stress, in fact, helps you make good decisions. It pumps your adrenaline up, it makes you think, it makes you focus on the problem at hand. The problem with this particular model, or the problem that this model demonstrates to us, though, is that of these five coping mechanisms of crisis, only one is effective. And what makes the difference for us is a couple of things. One is information. At each of these phases, the real difference is that we stop gathering information because where we are is where we stop. Either we stop because, well, I don't think this is really a crisis, so I stop gathering information. Or take it to the, I don't have time, so I'm not gathering any more information. So the real issue for us as emergency managers, and when we're talking about coping and leading in decision-making in crisis, is that we need to understand that we can't just stop with what's in front of us. We have to seek more information. We have to analyze information. We have to look at what the real crisis is. Otherwise, we get trapped in this model, and we end up in a coping mechanism that isn't necessarily the best way to do things. Okay? A little complex and a little complicated, but again, if you take this back to the idea that all we're really saying here is you need to actually focus on the problem, then I think it becomes a lot clearer. Let's talk about preparing for crisis. I talked about the Marquis of Pombal, and I talked about some of the things that Pombal did and why he was successful. So let's talk about how you set yourself up for that. The first, of course, is the support of your political leadership. Now, we all understand that, and we hear it in all the classes. Very few of us actually really do it and take it seriously. And it's not that difficult. In fact, one of the masters of dealing with politicians is sitting in front of me, my colleague Mike Sells. So if you can pick his brains, he's very good at it. But really, what we're talking about is you have to understand that politicians don't think like real people. Right? Oh, did the mayor leave, by the way? Politicians think differently. And unfortunately, they think short-term, and they think in terms of the basic question that I think a lot of people ask is, what's in this for me? Okay? So there are a couple of things you have to think about when you're approaching politicians. First is you have to understand that you need to be politically aware. Not necessarily politically involved in the sense of choosing a party or getting involved in politics, but you need to understand that the emergency management job is really political. If you don't believe that, look at some of the studies that correlate between political affiliations and disaster declarations. It will open your eyes. A lot of it depends on who's in the government, who's making the calls. There is a huge body of research that shows there definitely is a correlation between your political stance and whether you get disaster declarations. Secondly, to get anything done in the real world, stripping everything aside, you need two things: political will and money. And if you have political will, the money can usually be found. So getting involved with your local politicians, getting them to understand what you do, these are critical to your success in a crisis. So you really need to start educating your politicians. And that's one of the biggest things that I've learned over the years, is that they just don't understand what you do, and they don't understand what you can do to help them. And that's the important part. You have to phrase your arguments to them, not in terms of, this is the right thing to do, boss. There are a few that would be moved by that, but I would almost bet not a whole lot. And I'm being very cynical here, but really, the answer is, this is the thing. This thing will make you look good because it will help people, it's the right thing to do, all the rest of it. So you really have to think about how you frame your message, and I'm going to, in a minute, I'll talk a little bit about a way you can do that. The second thing to think about is your team. Now, there are two types of teams. You're probably familiar with this one, the 20 mule team. In 20 mule team, there's really only one person calling the shots. The team members don't have a lot of input, and if you're not the two mules in the front, the view never changes. Okay. This is not the team I'm talking about. What we're talking about are a couple of different levels of teams. The first, of course, is the team of professionals that you rely on to get things done. And we all have these networks, and we all have people. One of the things that you have to do, though, is understand that if you're going to pull a team together, you have to trust your team. One of the characteristics of a high reliability organization is deference to expertise. And unfortunately, I see a lot of organizations where people are brought in, they're experts in their field, and nobody pays any attention to them. Right. And again, we can pull a lot of examples from history of things where people have gone wrong because they didn't listen to the expert who stood up and said, this is wrong, this isn't going to work, this is going to kill people, and people have just ignored that. So you need to think in terms of your team and how you're going to defer to their expertise. But this isn't really what I came to talk about, because this is Emergency Management 101 and we all are familiar with that. What I really wanted to talk about is what Professor Usim, who's a Harvard specialist on leadership, calls your net. The people that you rely on when you're in a crisis. And by that, what I talk about is people that you can call up and say, what do you think about this? And they'll give you an honest answer. So it may not be people that are in your OC, it may not even be people that are in your jurisdiction, but you need to be able to reach out and make that phone call. It's kind of like that lifeline thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's kind of, so who's on your lifeline? But the idea is that you really need, as a leader, sometimes to vent, sometimes to seek new ideas. And the more you get people outside your realm of expertise, the more you'll get different types of ideas and different approaches. One of the problems we have is something called groupthink, where we all think alike. We all come from the same background. We all have the same experiences. We all tend to face problems the same way, particularly those of us in emergency management. A lot of us have prior experience in the military. A lot of us have prior experience in emergency services. We have a way of thinking, a mindset. And sometimes it's worth our while to go out and talk to people like academic colleagues, to friends that are in other professions, friends that work maybe in business continuity. So you need to think about, who are your circle of friends? Who are the people that are your net, your support system, people that you can reach out to? So when I talk about building your team, it's not just the folks that are in the Emergency Operations Center. It's really about the people that you can reach out to and ask for advice and ask for assistance. So I talked about the third thing that Pombal had was this idea of vision. And really, this drove everything that Pombal did. If you look from the very beginning, one of the very first things he did was he had the army surround the city and stop people from leaving. Why did he do that? Because he knew he was going to need people to rebuild, and he knows that when people become refugees, it's very hard to get them back. Look at what happened in New Orleans after Katrina. So we see this sort of thing over and over. So he stopped people from leaving. He gave incentives to the fishmongers to come in and sell food in Lisbon. He gave them tax credits. He created, as I say, the science of seismology and actually built mitigation into the new buildings to convince people it was safe to rebuild in Lisbon. So his idea, his vision, of course, was a restored Lisbon that was the center of Europe. Now, for us, we're a little more modest than that, but I guarantee that if you take your approach with your politicians and with your community, that your role is to be reactive. I respond to disasters. They will not take you seriously. You have made yourself essentially a fire extinguisher. Fire extinguishers are real. It's not a bad job, really, because most of the time you just have to hang around and look good. And that's what I did well in San Francisco. But if you're actually going to work, if you're actually going to be part of the team, you have to be accepted on your terms. And the surest way to do that is to link the vision of your emergency program with the community's vision. You have to demonstrate how you add value to the community. Again, this is getting back to that issue with the politician of saying, what is it that you do that helps me? You know, what's in this for me? And you can now say, instead of saying, well, I'm just hanging around waiting for a disaster to happen, you can say, no, I'm part of your, for example, your risk management system. If you look at this vision that the Principles of Emergency Management Group came up with, it's really talking about our value to the community. We promote safer communities. Right? We're not talking about we respond, we train, we exercise. That's not the point. We're trying to take the larger view here. So as you craft your vision, you need to understand at a time of crisis, what does this really mean to the community? It's really not about putting out the fires. People get angry at me sometimes because I'll look at them and I'll say, response is over in 10 days. And they're like, 10 days? What are you talking about, Lou? Well, yeah, because after 10 days, it's about the amount of time it takes for somebody to starve to death. So we've either solved the problem of feeding people or it's going to solve itself. We either put out the fires or the place is going to burn down. We either deliver water or people die. So one way or another, the problem is going to solve itself. But that's not the real issue for the community. That's the immediate problem, and that's what we're caught up in dealing with immediately. The real issue of leadership is, where do we want to be down the road? We sometimes forget that our job in the Emergency Operations Center is not just to do the same job that the first responders in the field are doing, but rather to look ahead. And by looking ahead, I'm not saying just 24 hours or 48 hours. Initially, that's probably the time window we're looking at. But we need to start thinking in terms of 6 months, a year. Where are we going to be? We're talking about recovery here. We're talking about restoration. Because ultimately, our value in the community will depend on how quickly we can help restore the community. And that's where the true value of emergency management comes in, is taking that long-term view. So returning to this idea of value, again, we have to look beyond just what we do day to day. We have to be able to articulate how we add value. We have to articulate why the community should make the investment in our expense. Okay, let's move on and talk about some of the mechanisms. We talked about the coping mechanisms and some of the mistakes. Let's talk about some things that you can actually do during a crisis that will kind of help pull things together for you. Let's talk about Albuquerque, New Mexico, March 7th, 2000. It's a company called Philips, and they manufacture microchips that go into cell phones. There's an electrical storm. There's a small fire that starts. Actually, it starts in the clean room along one of the production tables. The team is really good. They get on it right away. They put out the fire. It's really a little more than what we would call a trash can fire. It's not a big deal. And they look at the table and they realize they've lost about 8 trays of these chips, which works out to several thousand cell phones. It's a loss, but it's not a major calamity. Until they look a little further. Now, first of all, you have to understand about clean rooms. A clean room is a room where you manufacture chips, and the least little bit of dirt or grit is going to affect that manufacture. So a clean room is actually something like 20 times more sterile than an operating room. It's really a clean room. As they do their cleanup, they begin to realize that, yes, the actual fire damage only damaged a few trays, but the water from the sprinklers, the smoke from the fire itself, the actual actions they took to clean everything up meant that the clean room now has to be shut down and decontaminated, and they've lost several million chips, all the chips that were packaged for production. This is not the crisis, by the way. This is just the instigating part, because way in Finland, or not Finland, in Helsinki, the Nokia factory, within a matter of days, realizes something's not right because they miss one of their indicators. They have a system where they're tracking connections with folks, and they realize that Philips is not answering one of the things they normally do, so they escalated up the chain. It's 3 days after this fire before Philips starts to call people and say, we have a problem. At that point, they've decided that it's going to take a week to restore the clean room, and we're going to give most of our manufacturing capacity, what we have left, to our two main clients, Nokia and Ericsson. Okay. Nokia is already working on the problem because they had that indicator. So when this call comes in, they refer it up the system. They're already aware that there may be a crisis happening. They refer it up the system, and the guy that gets it has worked in clean rooms. He says if they think they're going to get this clean room up in a week, they're joking. So Nokia crafts a system, a three-phase approach to the problem. First is they go to Philips and they say, we'll give you our experts to help you get the room back up, to help you make your plans. The second is they take another team of experts and they say, look, we need you to redesign this chip so we can use other manufacturing facilities to make the chip. The third thing they do is they go out and they find every competitor that makes a similar chip and they start buying up stock. Switch over to the Ericsson company. The Ericsson company does not understand that they have a problem. They get the call from Philips and they say, yeah, okay, that's cool, and you're going to give us the next, most of the stuff. Yeah, okay, we're cool. The clean room is not brought online for another 6 weeks. By the time Ericsson realizes there's a problem, there are no chips to be found. Their production goes into a dive. The next quarter, Nokia posts a 42% increase in profits and has captured an extra 30% of the market share. Ericsson posts a $200 million loss. And eventually it affects the company, and they are in serious decline for about four more years. So what's the point? You have to recognize that there's a crisis occurring. It is amazing to me how many times I will start an exercise with that question and people will look at me blankly. Yeah, they're not all earthquakes. Yeah. Earthquakes are kind of fun because they kind of come as you are. You don't have to worry about them. You just sort of, oh, well, it happened. I'm still here. Life's good. Craig Fugate once told me, he says, listen, if you can take your pulse and take a deep breath, you're okay. So that's why I like earthquakes. But a lot of times there are things going on, and we need to recognize what is the real crisis we're dealing with. And again, this gets back to what we were talking about with the conflict theory model. It gets back to what we were talking about in terms of taking the long-range view. Because when you look at some of the events in history, it's not been the immediate crisis that's the problem, it's the follow-up to it, the ripple effect that goes on out. San Francisco, 1906, the earthquake was bad. Don't let anybody tell you it wasn't. It was a pretty serious earthquake. But the real thing that people remember is what? The fires. The fires that burned for 3 days and destroyed most of the city. Now, people remember that. You go back to Hurricane Katrina. The hurricane was bad. No question about it. If you look at some of the Gulf Coast towns that were wiped off the face of the map, it was a bad hurricane. But what do people remember? The flooding because the levees broke. It changed the whole tenor of the operation in New Orleans. So again, you have to look beyond what's going on and what's in front of you. And I think this is what is expected of a leader in crisis. Everybody else will be worrying about solving the immediate problem. And you've got good people to do that. You have to jump ahead. You have to think ahead. You have to look at the big picture and say, what's really happening here? 3 Mile Island. Everybody sort of remembers this one a little bit. It's really a very complex operation, and I don't want to oversimplify. But the simple problem was that a valve got stuck, and the team that was there for a variety of reasons didn't realize the valve was stuck open. And they took actions that basically made the problem even worse. So what was really going on, what really caused this problem, was that there was so much information coming in on the panel that they couldn't isolate the individual pieces that would have told them that, you know, this thing is overheating and lowering the level of coolant is not the answer because it's actually the opposite problem. So what's really going on in 3 Mile Island is failure to identify and isolate the crisis. And this idea of isolating the crisis is important, particularly for those of us that have to deal with lower level disasters and lower level crises. It is really easy to try to do two things at once. I'm going to run my regular office and I'm going to deal with this crisis. If it is a crisis, by definition, it should be the thing that you're focusing on. So you need to isolate the crisis. You need to take it out of the realm of the day-to-day. You need to put it into a context where that is all you're focusing on. And if that means delegating either the dealing with the crisis to somebody or delegating your day-to-day stuff to somebody else, you need to think in those terms. You need to think about pulling your team in and isolating them from all the other pressures they have on the outside. And this is not easy to do. I've been in a similar situation where we're running an emergency operations center and we're dealing with a crisis and the rest of the city is in normal mode and they're going home at 5 o'clock and they're not returning my calls because it's not a crisis to them. But by having your team focusing on the crisis, by focusing on the crisis itself and isolating it from all the noise that's out there, you're better able to deal with it. And this kind of gets in the area of information, and we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. We have the ability to gather an amazing amount of information, and sometimes what we're really looking for gets lost in the shuffle. New Orleans. Oh, God. Where to start, right? We could talk about this forever, but there's really one thing that I want to talk about, and that's the issue of information flow. One of the things that is just amazing to me is that it seemed that there was a real dearth of information at every level of the operation. The information was there, people were passing it up, and either people at higher levels didn't believe it, or they couldn't corroborate it, or they wouldn't verify it, or they didn't take action to see if it was in fact true. They did not realize the significance of the information. I think the telling point, the thing that is of most interest to me, is the Superdome and Convention Center. Were we dealing with one site? Were we dealing with two sites? was it a different name for the same site? Was it a site that had two different pieces attached to it? One of the things that's amazing, it was several days before the federal government realized that they were in fact dealing with two separate sites in New Orleans. And that, of course, obviously is going to have an impact on how you deliver resources. Focus was on the Superdome. They completely forgot the convention center was in a completely different part of the city. So the real issue for us is gathering information. This is, and I have a certain bias because one of the things that I worked with FEMA was with the development of a plan section that used a lot of resources that we had available. And one of the things that I learned that was a real hard lesson for me was that you don't just gather every piece of information you can, because there's a lot out there, particularly now when we start talking about blog sites, we start talking about Twitters, we start talking about all these information streams that are out there. So what we have to do is gather information with a purpose, and that purpose is to assist in decision making. So one of the things that we have to take charge of is to say, to make a decision, what information do I need? And push that out in the system. Start putting demands in the system. Rather than sitting and passively letting the information come to you, you have to aggressively seek information. I like to think that if I had been the plans chief and people were saying, what's going on in the Superdome thing, I would have sent a team to investigate. I would have ordered aerial overflights. I would have done a whole lot of things to try and figure out what the problem was. I like to think. You never know. And I don't want to judge my colleagues that were there, but at the same time, clearly one of the problems was information. So you need to think about your information flow. And as we talk about building your team, you need to think about who in your team are the ones that are going to gather information and assess it and develop it into a format that you can use to make decisions. The last thing your boss needs and last thing you as a leader need is to get a stack of information that's about 4 inches high and said, here's everything we know. I don't need that. I need a couple of pages that I can read real quickly that gives me the facts, gives me some options, something that we would call in the military staff study. So something that distills things down. So think about your information. Think about what information you need to collect to make a decision and how you're going to get that information. One of my favorite characters, George Patton. I spent some time in the military, and so I was always very fond of him and his approach to war. The Ardennes in December 1945, the war was essentially over. D-Day had occurred quite some time before. The American armies and the British army had been fighting across Europe. The Germans were on the defensive. They were retreating. It was just a matter of time before the Rhine was crossed, and everybody was convinced that the war is finally over and we're just about to go home. And in the middle of winter, in probably the worst weather available, the Germans mount a major counterattack at the Battle of the Bulge and spark what would be the biggest battle of the war. One of the things that affected the outcome of that battle was Patton's ability to take his army, the 6th Army Group, pull it out of an actual engagement with the German front line, turn north, and attack into the enemy's flank. How did he do that? Early on, as he was gathering information, he began to pick up ideas that possibly the Germans were getting ready to mount a counterattack. Nobody believed it would happen. Denial. So, but Patton did. And so what he had his staff do was just to draw up contingency plans, to think in alternative ways. And when the time came, he was able to actually implement those plans. So you have to consider alternatives. When you're dealing with crisis, you have to be open to alternatives. And some of them are really crazy. One of the principles of emergency management is flexibility. And that flexibility means that we are used to ambiguity and we're used to making decisions without a lot of information. We really have to think in terms of different creative ways. One of the things we need to understand is a plan is not a Bible. A plan is not a set of commandments clad in stone. A plan is a toolbox. Now, all of you I know have used every tool in your toolbox exactly as it was intended by the manufacturer. I know this. Right? In my case, however, I have this big screwdriver. I'm not sure I have ever turned a screw with that screwdriver. I have used it for a pry. I have used it to stir paint. I have used it as a chisel. I have used it to use as a hammer at the last minute. I've used it for all sorts of things other than its intended purpose. And that's what I mean by considering alternatives. How do we use things creatively? At the time of September 11th, the city of Washington, D.C. did not have a terrorism plan or a plan for evacuating the city. But they did have a whole series of plans for dealing with crowds, for recalling police officers, for evacuating certain parts of the city. And they pulled those together, they got creative with them, they took pieces from here and from there, and they were able to make it work. So this idea of considering alternatives and using things in creative ways is absolutely essential. Battle of Gettysburg, second day of the battle. It's not been a good couple of days. Those of you who are familiar with the battle are going to say cringe as I talk through this in very, very fast. But essentially, the Union has fortified a ridge. The Confederates are trying to take the ridge. The second day of the battle, the Confederates are attacking on the Union left. And there's a hill called the Little Round Top. The general that is supposed to be holding this hill has moved his division forward, where it's being promptly slaughtered by the Confederates because he shouldn't have been where he was. And the hill is now exposed. From this hill, enemy cannon can enfilade the entire Union line, which means the battle is over if the Confederates take this hill. A unit is rushed into place, and the battle is on for most of the day. Actually, it's later in the afternoon. At a certain point in the battle, the commander, Joshua Chamberlain, realized that his men are out of ammunition. And he has only two options, as he can see it. One is to retreat, or one is to surrender. Joshua Chamberlain, who later gets the Medal of Honor for this, comes up with a third alternative. He orders his men to fix bayonets, and then he executes a complicated military maneuver of a turning motion as they attack, and they attack downhill into the Confederate line with the bayonets. The attack is so ferocious that the Confederates are thrown back and surrender, and the battle, as you know, is now, it turns into a completely different battle. So what's the point? Act. All of the stuff that we've talked about is fine and good, but if you don't take action, if you don't make a decision, then you are not a leader. You are just spending your time spinning your wheels like everybody else. So at a certain point, you have to make a decision. You have to take responsibility and you have to act. Now, one of the things that I think paralyzes a lot of people when we start talking about action is that people have a tendency to wait for all the information they can possibly get, or wait for permission, or wait for somebody else to say go. You can't do that in a lot of these crisis situations. The rule of thumb that I was taught years ago is if you're 80% ready, go. You know, the amount of time it takes you to get the remaining 20% is going to make a big difference. It's not really worth it. If you're 80% ready, act. So one of the things I think you need to understand when we're talking about leadership is you're sticking your neck out. There's no question about it. You're taking personal responsibility for the success or failure of the decision that you make. And I think this is an important part about being a leader, and something that we've tended to avoid over the last few years in emergency management is we're real hesitant to make decisions. We hesitate to order evacuations because we're afraid there'll be comeback, and we get people caught because we didn't evacuate soon enough. We hesitate to make decisions about withdrawing and reforming a fire line on another portion because we're afraid of what people will say if we lose some property, and firefighters die trying to save structural fires in the wilderness. So, I mean, there are all sorts of examples that we can look at where people fail to act for all the wrong reasons. So, my suggestion to you is, at a certain point, you look around, if nobody else is doing it, you take action. And that's part of being a leader. Let's return back to where we started, the earthquake in Lisbon and the fire. And once again, cover this idea that what was really successful about Pombal's action wasn't the fact that he put out the fires, which he did, wasn't the fact that he fed people, which he did, wasn't the fact that he cleared debris, which he did, but the fact that he understood that long range he had to rebuild the city, and from day one he was starting towards that. He was already understanding where he was going to need to clear the street. By the way, they had a plan within 10 days. In 10 days they came up with, they actually had 5 options that the architect gave them. One of which included doing nothing, and one of which was move the city to better ground. And so ultimately, Pombal had a plan in place and was acting on it within 10 days of the disaster. That's pretty fast, and you can imagine us trying to do that in modern times. If you look back, City of Chicago, after the Great Fire, same thing. They had a plan. They started implementing it. It took several years, but it came back and looked pretty good. City of San Francisco had the Burnham Plan after 1906. They never implemented that one, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons. So a confluence of the right time, the right person, the right authorities, obviously it had a lot to do with it. But I think the important part is what Pombal did and what you can do is to consider the big picture. And I can't stress this enough. I know I've covered it several times. I just want to reiterate it. You have to understand what is going on in the crisis, that it is not just about those initial few days. Yes, that's going to take up a lot of our resources. Yes, that's going to take up a lot of our time. And I'm not saying, no, we shouldn't be doing it. But what I'm saying is, if you are a leader, you have to not only focus on what's going on right in front of you, you have to look long term. You have to think in terms of what's going to happen 2 weeks from now, a month from now. Let me give you a very simple example. There is a tremendous amount of information we can gain that will help us in mitigation right after an event, particularly an earthquake. We go in, we look at buildings, we assess why they failed, what we could do better next time. If you wait to think about mitigation until you've already done debris clearance, we've lost all that data, all that information. So something as simple as that. If you're in the private sector, waiting to bring your processes back online is not unthinkable because you lose money. So again, we have to think the same way as emergency managers. We have to think about, there are things that I should be doing on day one that will affect our long-range plans. What are those things? And where do I prioritize them with the other things that I have to do that are immediate, such as saving lives, putting out fires, helping shelter people, and so forth. So I guess what I'm really talking about is this idea of responsibility. That we really, as leaders, the buck kind of stops with us. That we really have to understand that it's up to us to make those decisions. We're not going to be thanked for it. Sometimes we're going to be wrong. But the fact is, if we don't do anything, then nothing gets accomplished. Nothing changes. We get stuck in that denial mode, or we get stuck in that area of deliberation where we're just spinning our wheels. So at some point, we have to accept responsibility and say, yes, this is the decision I'm going to make. I'm going to pause for just 1 second here. I'm hoping that I've given you enough value that you've enjoyed my presentation. If you have, I'd really appreciate it if you'd stop by my speaker mix page and leave a comment. Or if you didn't enjoy it, yeah, you can do that too. I won't like you as much, but I'd appreciate it. And the other thing is, normally I'd ask for questions with this larger group. Where I've been told that we really don't have time for that. Oh, well, Mike says I can have one. So are there any questions real fast? Okay. I just want to point out, though, that I will be around in the conference all day today and most of tomorrow morning. So if you'd like to stop by and ask me a question, please do so. If you have comments on this, please do so. If you'd like to record a video testimonial, I also do that. So here endeth the commercial announcement. Let me leave you with a final thought. Vince Lombardi, I think, sums up what I've been trying to say today. We have this tendency to think that the leaders are the other guys, that they're born people, or they're people with authority, or they're people that are somehow different from us. What I really believe is that every one of us has the potential to be a leader. Some of us have it naturally. We're the kids that led up the softball team in grammar school, or we're the ones that, you know, you're patrol leaders in the scouts or whatever. And then there's some of us that are just quiet, and we have it thrust on us that we don't know what we're going to do. There was a fire chief in the city of San Francisco who was retired, and he was basically out the grass. He was done when 1906 hit, and the chief, who was a real visionary, was killed. He was the first casualty. And this quiet, unassuming man, who was considered fairly ineffectual, managed to somehow pull things together at the last major fire line and hold the line. So you never know who is going to emerge as a leader. And so you can, in fact, develop your leadership skills. Leaders are made, they're not born. You can learn about leadership, and we learn by doing. The more decisions you make, the more you use the processes that we've talked about, the easier it gets for you. Now, I'm not saying that you get to the point where you can make a major decision in a crisis with no problem whatsoever, but you will certainly find it easier to make decisions if you practice. Read about decision-making theory, make decisions in exercises, practice what you preach, but understand that at a certain point, people are going to be looking towards you. And you have a choice at that point. You can either continue to do nothing, get stuck in that deliberation and the denial phase, or you can choose to act. And how you act will depend on how well you've prepared yourself and the work you put in. Thank you all very much.